everybody. Welcome to the Green Architects Lounge podcast. I'm your host, Chris Briley.
And I'm your host, Phil Kaplan. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Phil. Here we are again.
Always fun.
Always fun. What are we talking about today?
I'm glad you asked that. I figured you might ask that at some point.
It's going to come up.
Yeah. Offsite construction and high performance.
Perfect.
Yeah, this is something very near and dear to me. Because I've been in the offsite construction world for a handful of years now. And
yeah, you're definitely going to be taking first chair on this episode between the two of us. So it'll be more like me interviewing you as we go through this. Well, I'll chime in with my limited experience, but it's nothing compared to the world that you've been immersed in with Brightbuilt.
I imagine you'll have plenty to say as well. If history is any indicator,
I'm going to be talking too much.
Maybe more than me. Who knows?
Probably. I'll try to let you get a word in edgewise.
Thank you.
Yeah, and you were just right before the mics went on, you were telling me about you just did a little thing with Revision, and as folks may remember, we had Revision Energy in the studio. We had Fred and Jeff talking about solar storage, and then you returned the favor by showing up and doing a little something for them media wise.
Right, doing a little podcast, and we'll post a link. Perfect. To their podcast for Revision Energy.
Yeah,
at some point. But yeah, I went in and talked to Fortunat. They wanted to talk about solar and architects, how we treat solar, how we think about it. And we do.
Yeah.
I do. You do.
I do.
One of the interesting things that came out of it is just as a follow-up to the episode that we had done a couple times ago.
Yeah.
Was about solar storage. That Fortunat really believes that solar storage not only is an option in the future, but soon everyone will be having solar storage in their houses. We're just, not far away.
Just like by default, by just the technology is catching up, that it's going to just start to make sense.
Absolutely. And it'll have to do with, you know, handling
our grid,
off-hour lows in the grid, and you know, understanding when peak load is, and being able to buy energy when it's cheaper. Essentially, we could buy any energy when it's cheapest in the middle of the night.
Gotcha.
Essentially. And then
store it up. Of course, you're not making it in the middle of the night. But I get what you're saying. Use the battery.
We use the battery in the middle of the night. We're assuming that you've got a rooftop solar full array. Of solar.
So. Sure. Makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Anyway. But we're not talking about that.
No.
Now we're talking about
cocktails.
Cocktails. Shall we talk about this cocktail? So Chris had a great idea. We were trying to figure out which cocktail we would.
Yeah.
Make today. And if this is the Corpse Reviver. Yeah. Corpse Reviver number two.
Right.
Because just in time for Halloween.
Exactly. I thought, Phil, don't you have anything for, Halloween? And yes, Corpse Reviver.
Yeah. And this revives your corpse a bit, doesn't
yeah,
it?
It's, oh, it's, my gosh. I have to say, I'm going to be drinking these more often, probably. So,
yeah.
These are good.
And not only is it good, it's super easy. This is really one of my favorite drinks. Of all time, one, it's delicious.
Mm-hmm.
Always a crowd pleaser.
Mm-hmm.
And it's super easy to make.
Yeah.
Because it's equal parts. Four ingredients, equal parts.
Perfect. And they are?
Lemon juice.
Yep.
Gin.
Yep.
Cointreau.
Yep.
And Lillet Blanc.
Right.
Sounds fancy, but it's not. It's just like a wine liqueur.
Sounds French.
Sounds French. French is,
which
means
is fancy.
Fancy, apparently. Right. Yes.
And then you've garnished this with a... nice little sprig.
A sprig of rosemary. Just because we got it out of our CSA, and that's wrong.
What?
It's actually wrong. You really want a bar spoon of absinthe.
Oh, and
instead of that. But you four ingredients, bar spoon of absinthe. But we've added just a little sprig of rosemary and whack it on the edge and mix a little bit in. And it sure looks pretty dope, doesn't it?
It sure does.
And it does a similar thing that the absinthe does as an aromatic.
So if I had absinthe at home, which I have to be honest, I don't. But if you used absinthe, you wouldn't use the rosemary, or you
would
do both?
No, you just use the absinthe.
Right. If I wanted to be fancy, would I do both?
You are fancy, and you probably should.
All right. Good. Well, cheers.
Cheers.
Buddy. And cheers, Tanner. We're at the Portland Pod, of course, and coming at you not live probably by now, but here we go.
Live to us.
Okay. So offsite construction.
What is offsite construction?
All right.
So this is a term that we bat about
because
in the industry.
Right, because like if you say offsite construction, it has like if I said prefab, oh man, the connotations of double wides just like fill your brain, right?
To some, but there was the whole Dwell revival
Yeah.
What about 15 years ago?
Yeah.
What people just flipped out about prefab and said, this is a great thing.
Right. They're like, this is the wave of the future.
And that's when prefab really came apparent to this generation, sort of our current generation. But what does prefab mean? A lot of people said, well, you do prefab.
Right.
And we say, yeah. I mean, that just means prefabricated parts.
Right. So it's really offsite, somewhere else. There's guys in a factory setting of some kind, or, you know, slapping together components to some level.
Yeah. Slapping might be a little harsh.
Yeah. Word. All right.
That's the perception, Chris.
Right.
We're going to beat that perception today.
Exactly. They are skillfully putting together.
Some. Here we go.
I can't win. It's
a story.
Yeah.
But, you know, the point is they're putting pre-assembling stuff that turns into a building.
Right.
So there's modular building,
mm-hmm.
which is a lot of people think about as mobile homes.
Right.
Right. Which is not really true, although mobile homes are still built in a modular factory.
Yeah.
There's panelized. There's SIPs.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, you know, prefab is all encompassing. You know, what's the difference between them? You know, is it worth talking about that? Just
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Because panelized, I've done more panelized work than prefab work. Panelized would be, as it implies, the walls, like components are brought in, not like, look, with modular, someone says modular to me, I'm thinking a half of a unit is like being delivered or it's assembled to the size of a truck or what can fit on a flatbread mm-hmm. and be shipped. So it might be half of a unit that is lifted up into place, but panelized is like wall components that are all stacked up on, they come stacked up on a truck and then they get lifted into place and then they are, you know, maybe the insulation's in them, maybe not. Maybe the sheathing, maybe the siding, mm-hmm. maybe even the windows. And so there's different levels of panelization, different levels of components.
I mean, right. And I would list SIPs as panels.
Yep. Trusses, sort of.
Right. They're kind of.
Yeah.
Right there. Yeah. So, and everything is prefab.
Yep. Sure.
Everything is offsite.
Yeah.
But the big difference here are the panels and the modular builds.
Right.
So the difference between the panels is you talk about, you know, pieces of wall, you know, pieces that are put together. Modular is essentially big chunks. Like you see, they're actual boxes.
Right.
That have structure. So when you ship modules, you're actually shipping air.
Right.
Where you ship panels, they're actually, you know, stacked together very tightly.
Right. Now, I remember going to a session led by John Straub
mm-hmm.
at NESI, and I think you were there too. I think we were in the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he talked about that component, about delivering modular things and how they're mostly filled with air. And, you know, because it's a volume that you're shipping. And I had maybe this is the hot zig for the, you remember the hot zig?
Yeah, we can. This is episode number 50. We didn't celebrate that, Chris.
Oh my God, you're right.
By the way, this is episode freaking 50.
Nice. Woohoo.
That's a hot zig in and of itself.
Right.
But bringing back the hot zig.
The hot zig. The great ideas, which we called hot zig in honor of my father, grandfather, who used to always just say, hot zig. Great idea. Great. But anyway, so maybe the idea there is if you're a modular company shipping these things, you should partner with like a company that ships, I don't know.
Dog food.
Dog food or
ping pong balls,
typewriters.
Never partner with a typewriter company.
No,
anymore.
You're in trouble there. But you know what I'm saying? Then you can fill the double wide. Oh, I shouldn't say that. You fill the modular. I know. I'm just ribbing you now. I'm just teasing you. No, you fill the modular unit with something, and you ship it with, you know, you ship it freighted, as they say in the biz.
Yeah.
So, but anyway.
Brilliant.
Yeah. So how prevalent is this in the United States, Phil? Like you've done the research.
It's 0.03%.
You're kidding.
That's it. You think, oh, there's a lot of people kicking out these houses that you see. You know, everyone's seen these driving down the road.
Yeah.
At least the modules. It's really that small.
Wow. So when you say point, is that of the construction market or just like all the houses in you, or I don't know.
I don't know what the difference is, but it's essentially all the houses in the U.S.
That's really low.
You know what it is in Germany?
No.
14%.
Dang.
Sweden?
Yeah?
33%.
Holy crap.
Don't you sort of think those countries are, they might be a little smarter than us. I don't know. I think.
Well, as if history is an indicator there, they are usually ahead of the American curve in terms of technology and energy efficiency. And they're a bit more progressive, let's say, than they use the metric system. They concern themselves with such things. They don't build with toxins like we do as much. So,
and we've looked at these countries, especially Germany, for things like passive house and great windows and doors.
Right. So
they're ahead of many of the things that we are doing now. So
yeah. So you're feeling like, and I guess I would feel the same way that this is a trend that's increasing. Like we're going to see more modular, more offsite, more panelization.
I absolutely think so.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why in a minute, but first, I want to talk about where modular came from.
Sure.
Do you remember the Sears kit house?
Yes. I mean, I know of it. I don't actually remember it. Like
as you were not alive.
I wasn't paying attention, but in my...
Because you weren't alive in the 20s.
Right. My architectural history brain is aware of the Sears home kit and how that's, you know, a real revolution in terms of home delivery. You too can have this module.
That's house. Right. You're in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the middle of the country. Yep. You know, in the early 20s.
Yeah.
You're not a home builder, or you know, you have somebody in your family who's tried to build a house and it's barely standing.
Right. There's no Home Depot.
You see this in I don't know, Life magazine. What magazine was out then? I'm not quite sure.
I don't know.
Yeah. But it was advertised that you could buy a home and have it shipped to you, and that's exactly what they did. Sears.
Yep.
Manufactured these houses and they shipped them as kits.
Yep. And I know that
they went on trains and they were put back together over and over and over again.
Post-war, World War II, that was like the big boom of the Sears home kit, wasn't it?
Like, it was.
Like, yeah.
Yeah, even before that, but you know, they started earlier than that.
Right.
But that's how you were going to get a quality home built.
Right.
You'd have to get it built from afar and delivered to you.
So why did that fall out of fashion? I mean, because it sounds like that, you know, back then, that's where the ramp up was starting to happen. What was the big...
Yeah, that's a really great question. You know, at some point, and I think this was in the 50s, and more like the 50s and 60s, where more people needed housing very quickly, and these factories sprung up and figured out, okay, well, we can deliver these houses. We can deliver them quick. They have to be light, and they have to go fast. And there were a lot of incentives at that point put in place to get these out there. I mean, just sort of by the nature of the fact that they could make more money if they get more of them out there faster. And the quality went way down.
Oh.
And the reputation went down.
You know, you're right. Because, like, I mean, the 70s, you think about a 70s double wide. In fact, there aren't that many 70s modular homes anymore. I mean, they're there, but it's like they are in not good shape.
Yeah. And the other thing is that the affordable housing industry said this is a great opportunity for us. And it was.
Yeah.
The regulations were put in place to allow these houses to be built to a lower quality. Stairs were allowed to be much steeper. Walls were allowed to be thinner.
Yeah.
2x4, 2x3 walls was that many of these houses were being built out of. And nobody was really watching it.
Right.
So here we get our reputation of the crappy mobile home.
Right. And then who wants that?
Yeah, it's completely pejorative of connotations. And yet,
right.
On paper, this is our great opportunity to do something great. And somehow we as a country botched it.
Right.
So there's a lot of people out there working to fix that reputation.
So really, now is sort of the moment where modular is going to really... And offsite is really going to, it has an opportunity to get legs again. I mean, with Dwell, you know, covering it and.
Yeah, there's so many reasons why. One of the great stats that I had researched was that 60% of the U.S. building stock will need replacement in the next 15 years.
Wow.
60% in the next 15 years.
Wow.
And AIA 2030 corroborates that. Their numbers are slightly different. They say, I think, 75% in the next 30 years or something like that. But this is, how are you going to do that much work? How are you going to build that many homes?
And do it in a carbon neutral way, Phil.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right now we're suffering from, there's a dwindling stock of tradespeople. People are just not going into the trades.
Yeah.
This is really interesting too, Chris. 25% of all factory construction workers are female.
Oh.
Only 4% of construction workers on site are female.
Dang.
Right? So what's going to solve our dearth of tradesfolk?
Let's bring more diversity into it.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting, though?
That's very interesting.
That says a lot about the construction industry and some of the issues with it.
And it says a lot about that environment, really, that is more, female friendly. Is that a good way to say it?
Yeah.
You know, to have a...
It's safer. I mean, instead of, a woman going off to a building site, which may be in the middle of nowhere with a handful of dudes, there's something about that that
right, understandably as opposed to the same sort of factory environment where you clock in and you get to work and you work with the same people and...
And the regulations are typed out on the wall, and people are keeping an eye on things.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, Phil. I mean, this sort of the social justice piece that is tied into so many things.
Wow.
Let me ask you this, Chris.
Yeah.
So in terms of offsite construction, why would you guess people are interested in it?
I would guess because...
What do you think of when you think of offsite construction?
Well, what do I think
This
of
is good because...
Quality control is what they're going to think.
Okay.
They're going to think they can get... here's what I really think.
Mm-hmm.
I think from a design standpoint,
mm-hmm.
it's more product-oriented than service-oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you hire an architect, there's no product per se. It's you're hiring me to design your house, right? And it doesn't exist. Whereas, an off-site situation, a lot of times, like in a more modular way, it's like I'll have the Phil Kaplan 2000 model, and I like this, but can I tweak the kitchen and can I add a little thing here and change the finishes here to that?
If we have to replace 60% of our housing stock in 15 years, very few people get the Phil Kaplan model.
Right.
They're lucky people,
Listen, no one can afford the Phil Kaplan model. That is going to be a spectacular model. It's going to be beautiful. No, but I think that it's more product focused. And maybe another perception is that there's greater quality control. It's built in a factory mm-hmm. setting. You don't have the weather elements and all that, which I already know from John Straub's presentation that may not necessarily be 100% true.
No, I still think it is.
Yeah.
I still think most, the house ostensibly is being built indoors.
Correct.
The pieces are being assembled together outside
and that needs quickly. To be planned for, but.
Right.
Right. So does that match up with
it? What speed?
Speed.
Faster.
Yeah.
4 weeks shorter on average for production homes. That's what.
Yeah,
that's some of the stats are saying, but we're finding that it's typically half the time. Honestly, what do you think about the construction of a house? How long is it going
to
take?
Yeah, if a client asks how long does it take to build a house, I say 8 months to a year,
mm-hmm.
and a year is a better thing to plan for.
Yep, these are 4 months is slow in the factory,
and see
15 days is,
and throw into bad. That design where. If you're choosing a product, let's say, like a house design mm-hmm. that's already, you're going to meet with a designer, tweak it, and then order it, and then have it shipped. It's going to come way faster than, starting from scratch with an architect and designing a bespoke
home. Right, but
if you took the
whole design piece out of it, just the construction itself, they're all the same materials. If a factory is at the very least half the time to build, and often much less than that. That's a big reason.
That's a huge reason. Sure.
Waste reduction is something you didn't mention.
Yeah. Waste reduction. Like you will. I think there's more. Typically, you're going to correct me on this. There's more material in an offsite home typically, but it's in an industrial environment, or it's in a. It's being built in an environment where that waste can be captured and reused way more efficiently.
That's right, and optimized. Yeah, when it's constructed.
Right.
Because every stick is drawn. So you know when you can cut a stick in half and use one piece here and one piece there.
Right.
All those things are taken into account.
Right. And it's really easy to put it over there and use it later for the smaller thing mm-hmm. in a factory setting.
Yep.
than on a job site where you're building just one house.
Just one house, exactly. Then, you know, are you going to bother to take that stick and transport it and save it?
Yeah, probably not.
Probably not. Scheduling advantages. I mean, this is tied into speed, but here you are having all your trades in one place.
Right.
One right after the other. You don't have to wait for the plumber to show up. And when he cancels on you, say, oh, damn it. Now I got to wait. Now I got to come up with something else.
The whole schedule just shifted a week because this guy's kid had the flu. Damn it.
Yeah, it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
The next box is right there rolling down the line.
Right. And you know, same with that scheduling. I mean, repetition, doesn't that, like if you're repeating like very similar, even if it's not the exact same design, you're, you know, the similar components.
Certainly the similar task, you know, in my mind, I'm trying to take away the pejorative notes of this.
Yeah.
That you're building all the same thing, because that's not a good answer either.
No, but maybe the way you approach it, more assembly line-ish, you know, what am I doing today? I'm applying sheathing. And what am I doing tomorrow? Applying sheathing. And the next day, applying sheathing.
That's right.
It's like, you know, it doesn't vary as much. And maybe...
You might say it gets boring for some folks, but you really have the opportunity to optimize that task. It's just like any assembly line thing.
Right.
There's pluses and minuses, but it's certainly faster. This is an interesting one, is purchasing power.
Yeah.
Some people don't think about that, but you know, you have the factory saying, all right, we are going to use these windows or these cabinets.
Oh, interesting. So
and they get a big old deal.
So the factory themselves can leverage that.
That's right.
That.
And we need that, because otherwise that's going to be very expensive too. We need the factory to make money in other places.
Wow. Instead of one house, instead of window companies competing for one house project, they're actually competing for, maybe even hundreds of houses.
Yep.
So they're like, they'll lower the price. Dang.
Yeah.
That is something I hadn't really thought about.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's kind of like it's a little Walmart-ish.
Yeah.
You know, again, here's these things that are like, ooh, Walmart-ish. But at the same time, if we can use it, if they can use their powers for good, and they're doing high-performance buildings, that's okay. And, you know, and here's the other thing that we get maybe on top of all these things. Oh, these are cheaper, right?
Are they?
Sometimes.
Right.
But not always.
Right. Like, I think of Benson Wood when this comes up. Like you've been to their factory, right?
Yeah.
Where it is, they have this dialed in, and they've got tables that, you know, a big thing comes down and fills an entire panel with cellulose in a second and then flips it over, and they, you know, start, you know, applying all the different layers. They can build it from both sides. And, you know, they deliver a very high performance wall system. But dang, is that expensive compared to, you know, I don't know how many times I've come very close to, you know, using a Benson Wood product and then have a builder say, well, we'll do it.
Well, in defense of Benson Wood, yes,
sure,
they have their custom panelized system, which is really an unbelievable system for high quality.
Oh yeah.
Panelized homes.
But they're
definitely more expensive.
Yes.
But then that's why they came up with the Unity line.
Right.
And their new Tectonics factory, because they really realized they had to compete.
Right.
So, you know, kudos to Ted and his crew for
doing
great things.
Absolutely.
But you know, in and of itself, even that one company shows you that there's a large range
of
cost.
And I didn't mean to disparage them. I hope that didn't come across that way.
No,
because it's a very very high quality product. So, yeah. I know the times that we have used panelization, like the Main Coast Waldorf School, it's a double stud wall in places, in most of the building. And that was all panelized. And the primary reason was because wintertime was when it was going to get assembled.
Mm-hmm.
So it was either these guys were going to stick frame this thing on site in the winter, or they needed to bring it in and be shell tight, you know, within a week, you know, just like clear a site, bring in the panels, put this thing together, make it, you know, waterproof, you know, weatherproof, and then they could, you know, freely build the rest of the building. Ideally, winter's not a great time in Maine to be building, but sometimes you are just pinched into that situation,
given
school schedules and
budgets. And guys do it anyway.
Oh,
You go out to you know, jobs, you'll see a job site. You'll see folks framing in January. Absolutely, you will. They'll get up, clear the snow off, they'll put on their gloves, and they'll try to miter a joint.
Yeah.
In the cold.
Dude, that is
and
why.
14 degrees.
That is why I'm not a builder. Like every summer it happens where I think, you know what? I could be a builder.
I could do this.
I want to get out of my desk and I want to go build something with my hands and whatever. And then it starts getting cold and rainy and miserable. And then you think, oh man, I got to get up every morning. I got to poop in that blue box over there where it's, you know, 2 degrees outside and try
a fancy French person like yourself, Chris, will not tolerate that.
Oui.
I'm with you. I
know. And especially now at my age, I'm like, oh, it would grind on me. But these guys, God bless them.
They're amazing. But you know what? I bet every single one of them would rather be indoors.
Yeah. So.
Maybe there are a few who wouldn't. But
There's a few. They're crazy few who really are just special to our hearts. But so what do you think about the future of this? I mean, I feel like this is a trend that's definitely on an upswing. Right. I mean, you're feeling that probably.
Yeah. Just like high performance, sometimes it's hard to see the forest through the trees because if we're in it, that's what we see. But it sure seems like that to me. Things are, you know, the trends say, the research that I've done says that more people are turning to this as a solution. Mm-hmm. And again, it has a lot to do with the increased demand for housing stock. And I think with high performance, it really comes into play because there's a lot of houses out there that need. That really need to be improved in terms of quality. They just can't withstand these winters anymore, and they're failing.
Yeah.
So
but even in warmer climates, weather aside, you think it's still
still speed is an issue. You know, and I think your example of the school being penalized.
Yeah.
It's something that people don't really see and don't necessarily consider offsite construction. But there's many, many buildings these days are being built.
Sure.
At least the walls are being pre-framed.
Yeah. What about negatives of it? Like, what do you feel like if I said, Phil, what's the worst part about panelization? What's the biggest struggle? Maybe that's a bit better thing to say.
I think we need a whole podcast.
Oh, well.
No, I'm kidding.
That podcast.
That's right. I guess so. I'll try to limit. No, there. We've learned a lot in the last. So my other business, Bright Build Home, has been formally in existence for 5 years. We started in 2014, but we did our first net zero modular home that was finished in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been over 10 years, and we've learned a lot since then.
Yeah.
Every factory is different. And I think, in terms of getting this out so other architects can use this, which needs to happen. Mm-hmm. I think there's definitely a learning curve of understanding how the factories work, because it's different than drawing something up and then having a builder assemble it stick by stick.
Yeah. Well, I know in the next half, we're going to talk about limitations and things, but I was just curious what your biggest challenge is. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it is making that translation. It is. Yeah. It's thinking differently about your design, and sometimes that has to be your design has to be tuned to whoever is building that design.
Oh, I see.
Like we usually don't tune our designs to a builder,
right? But in this case, there's one way that this factory is building. So
that's right. Or we can choose to do it our way, but the factory will say, if you did it our way, it'd be a lot cheaper.
Oh yeah, I got a story there. I don't know if now is a good time.
I'd like to hear it now.
All right. Well, but long ago, I did some modular stuff with my old company but I was working for another company, and it was some affordable housing. It was infill housing and it was multi-story housing, and the whole idea was we were going to design these units to be replicated over and over again. So let's make them modular, and so we. Working with the owner, shopped it around with a couple of different companies, and we found one, in Canada that was way cheaper. And you met with them, and it was like,
yes, the Canada problem.
Yes, and they were like, we, whatever you draw it, we can do it. And that was really just, can we do
this? And they had the pictures on their website of all the things they've done really cheap.
Yeah, yeah, and they talked all about it. and they got the commission. And sure enough, we sent them the drawings, and then the shop drawings came back, and oh my God, they looked terrible and very different. And we were like, what happened? And they said, well, see how you have these roof pitches. They're over a certain size or whatever. They're too steep and, you know, yada, yada. And so we made them like this.
We reduced your 12-12s to 3-12s. Right. I hope that's okay.
Right. And your trim here is too fat. We did what we normally do. And like your nice little eaves, we made the mutton chops because that's what we do. You know, it's just easier.
Right.
And it's like, what? No, you said whatever we do, we enjoy, you know, so there's this big, everything became a fight. You had to fight for your design. And so I guess that was just like one of those sour moments where like, you know, that it was not easier.
But if somebody said, Chris, you need to work with this factory.
Right.
You'd go, all right, what do you do? Well, we have big chunky trim.
Yeah.
All right, we'll try to design around it. We have mutton chops for all, you know, our corner returns.
Uh-huh.
All right, we'll make sure everything's a shed.
Yeah.
We're not going to do that.
Yeah.
We don't want to see it. If that's, you know, you'd learn their rules and you'd design around it. And
yeah.
You'd have a better product.
Hmm.
I'm not saying it would be easy, and it would certainly be limiting.
Right.
And I think that is some of the limitations that you see in this industry, at least for now, until things get more standardized, which may be coming.
Right.
And I honestly think they have those issues in Europe. I think that things come out of factories, and then there's a certain sameness to a lot of those designs.
Right. Well, there's a lot of these guys out there, that I think are, like, growing, at least here in Maine, you know? Like, I think of EcoCore. I think of Chris Corson and EcoCore up there.
Yeah. Chris is doing amazing stuff with Passive House.
Yeah.
Panelization.
Right. He actually has a product that's that's certified, Passive House certified, a panelized product, which I don't know if there's any others that are like that.
No, I mean, Geologic, I think of, and
yeah,
their GeoHome product, they're doing a great job. And I know I don't know if they're Passive House across the board.
Right.
But they're certainly high performance and they're, you know, good product.
Right. And, you know, there's a case of a panelizer, you know, like there's even certain lumber yards around here. They'll do panelizing, or they've got panelizing arms of their businesses. And, you know, that's more of a shop drawing process. It's not necessarily high performance home. It's more up to the architect to get things detailed right and then have the panels come in. And, you know, it's more of a frame and sheathing than full-on insulation and siding and windows.
Well, I think it's important to understand there's a bunch of companies sort of in this area, and they all, you know, it's easy to conflate them when they all actually do different things. I mean, there really are the manufacturers.
Yep.
And they're often, you know, sometimes they're considered the panelizers. They're the people who actually produce these things.
Right.
And then there's the designers and facilitation companies that basically oversee them. So you more often than not, if you're hiring somebody to give you a house, sometimes it's design build and sometimes it's a design facilitation company, but they're not the people who are actually constructing it all the time.
Right.
Sometimes they are, but often they're not. And this can be really muddy for folks.
Yeah.
I mean, does that seem muddy to you? And you understand it a little bit more.
Well, yeah, I'm an architect and I'm...
You've done this, right?
I've done some of this stuff.
Right.
I mean, I'm not like you, with Bright Bell Homes, you know, leading a whole company this way.
Well, the reason I know this is because we have to explain this to people over and over again.
Right.
For Bright Bell Home, for instance, we facilitate the design. We are architects who are essentially the quarterbacks of the process.
Mm-hmm.
You hire us. We have relationships with multiple manufacturers. We know how we've learned their rules.
Mm-hmm.
So we have our designs, we know their rules, we know where you are, we know how the system works. So we work with the manufacturer, we get you an on-site builder, and we design the thing that takes advantage and optimizes all these things under a certain price.
Gotcha.
So Unity Homes
does
a very similar thing.
Yeah.
Geo Homes does a very similar thing.
Yeah.
You know, this is where, like, Michelle Kaufman.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Remember her? Yeah. Rocio Romero.
Oh, yeah.
They were part of the Dwell movement.
Yeah.
Blue Homes is another one that does very much the same thing. Now, Blue Homes has taken it the next step. They actually do the construction.
Mm-hmm.
They used to do more what we did, and that they did construction, and then they would ship around the country.
Yeah.
And since then, they've stopped. that because it was too hard to say, you know, there's one blue home in Maine I know of.
Oh, wow.
And something happened with the door and they had to wait 14 weeks for a new door.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's not good.
No.
So, but now they're in California and it's just fine.
Okay, well, good so, for them.
So, yeah, so, you know, issues of, you know, of those, you know, of that nature, if you're in charge of the design, can you, you know, from our perspective, we can work with multiple manufacturers. You know, and from their perspective, if they're building it themselves and selling it, they have a limited range of where they can serve.
Awesome. Well, listen, I think this is a great moment to take a break. And when we come back, Phil, I'm going to grill you on things like, you know, how we actually make this work for high-performance buildings, you know, like for the layperson out there, other architects out there, how do they start integrating this and if it's right for them? And just talk about, you know, the limitations and how to work with it and maybe even some cost implications.
Sounds good, Chris. Let's take a break.
Take a break. Hear from our sponsors.
This episode of Green Architects Lounge is proudly sponsored by Pinnacle Window Solutions, focused on providing high-performance window solutions throughout New England since 2009. With 70 years combined experience, Pinnacle Window Solutions has the expertise and knowledge to guide you through the most challenging window and door projects imaginable. More at pinnaclewindowsolutions.net. Now back to the Green Architects Lounge.
Welcome back.
Thanks, Phil. We're here.
We're here. And thanks to Pinnacle Window Solutions, our most excellent sponsor.
Our most excellent and consistent sponsor throughout the entire season so far. So cheers to them and the awesome work they do. Like we say every time, we don't just let any old schmo sponsor us. We
just only very special schmoes.
Special schmoes like Pinnacle Window Solutions and Chris Brill. What a guy.
I cheers you, but you're too far away now. But
I know. But
we'll drinks are refreshed.
I know. We are too far away. Can't reach each other. Mm. Anyway, my God, what a great drink this is.
Corpse Reviver number two.
Number two. There's a poop joke in there, but I'm leaving it alone, Phil.
Thank you. No, you didn't.
Taking the high road.
Just barely.
Barely.
So what do you want to continue talking about?
I want to talk about how, what's happening now is we've got offsite construction and like the work you're doing, like that Benson was doing in EcoCore, we're pivoting towards a high performance building envelope. Mm-hmm. And there's this opportunity where instead of the perceived, crappy quality that prefab has for some people, that connotation, it's going to flip-flop in a little bit. I think in a very short time, you're going to say prefab construction or off-site construction, and it's going to mean you're going off-site to get a particular product that is a high-performance product. And I know you're in it, you know, so I want to talk to you about, you know, how are you guys at BrightBuild doing it? How are you pivoting that conversation and actually delivering on it for an architect or for a homeowner or somebody who comes to you?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the interesting things that are going on right now are in the factories themselves.
Yeah.
And the reason I say this is because, again, you know, the folks actually building this are really key. Yeah, you know, we're helping move things along, but we're not the ones, you know, pounding the nails, and in this case, applying the insulation and applying the tapes and things like that.
Yeah.
So what we're working with a handful of great factories.
Mm-hmm.
New England Homes, KBS out of Maine.
Oh yeah,
Simplex out of Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, Preferred Building Solutions is also New England Homes out of Claremont, New Hampshire. You know, there's some fantastic folks. But what happens when we go and visit them is that we realize that when we train somebody or they train somebody, they're training a lot of people. So if a bit of information about to properly insulate this wall with cellulose to get the right, you know, the right pack.
Mm-hmm.
You teach one person, you know, that person is having much larger impact because many, many more homes are going through this much narrower part of the funnel now through factories.
Mm-hmm.
So we can disseminate this information on how to build higher quality, higher performance homes much faster.
So you are training the individuals on the floor, on the production floor.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
And so like you are disseminating this knowledge Much like a crew, you know, you're going to learn about air sealing or whatever. And
right. And it's not really us training the individuals actually doing it. It's us training the people, training the people.
Okay.
And a lot of the, right. you know, the people who are the foremen and the leaders at those factories are the ones who have the knowledge and they pass it on to their foreman.
Cool. And I'm assuming there's a sort of like a translation from from what the designer sees to what is actually, you know, dealing with the machinery in place and the products and, you know, translating that air tightness that you want to how it gets done on the floor.
Yeah. Yep. Very much so. And it's really walking through every detail with every factory, because again, different factories do things differently.
Dang.
So this piece of tape makes sense here. But in this case, you guys in this factory, you assemble your walls backward.
Whoa.
You start with a sheetrock and you go out. Oh, okay. That's interesting. How do we handle that when we typically do, you know, strapping or taping? And, you know, you just have to walk through these things. Bottom line is,
yeah,
a lot of this happens in, you know, in more homes constructed in fewer places.
So, Phil, do you think there's a greater efficiency of the product from an environmental standpoint? Like, I know that everyone's working towards an efficiency in terms of production and speed and all that, but are we seeing a more efficient planes? Sorry.
It's not you. I mean, clearly,
not you. Right. I mean, are you hearing it on?
Oh, yeah, I'm totally hearing it. I can't get rid of that.
All right. That's all right. We'll wait. Might be the same plane going around. I mean, seriously, he's circling until he has clearance. We might do this again.
Faster.
Here we go. So go ahead. All right. Are you punching it in, or are you?
Yeah.
I'll just go from now.
Yeah.
So, Phil, do you think that, with a factory assembly, you're getting greater efficiency from an environmental standpoint as well as a production standpoint, a cost and speed standpoint? It's also benefiting the environment.
Yeah, well, it has to be. I mean, you know, if you just started by the fact that you don't have workers individually driving to building sites all over the country that are, you know, can be anywhere. We're assembling things one stick at a time. Mm-hmm. Just the transportation costs saved.
Yeah.
Has to be a benefit. And then you think about the speed, and then the delivery of materials all happens to one spot instead of a lumber truck gets delivered to, you know, thousands of different houses,
yeah,
you know, in one town in some places. So right there, that, you know, the carbon footprint has to be dramatically reduced.
Yeah. Do you have any kind of in your research? Did you have a stat?
Yeah, I have a stat.
Oh, good. Thanks. Good.
CO2 emissions.
I was worried there wouldn't be stats in this podcast. We laugh.
CO2 emissions reduced by 43%. Oh, round numbers.
Oh, 40%?
By 40% or more.
Yeah? Okay.
On average, conventional construction results in 14.3 months and 98.9 metric tons of CO2 emissions, while modular construction takes only six months and results in over 50 metric tons of CO2.
All right, do that again in round numbers, can you?
All right. 14 months versus 6 months.
Yeah, in time.
100 tons of CO2 versus just over 50 tons of CO2.
Wow.
Cut in half.
Wow. So you're cutting all time in half and you're cutting CO2 in half, pretty much.
Pretty much.
Actually, let's use our round numbers. Right. You're cutting both those things in half,
That's
dude.
Right. And it makes sense.
It does make sense.
You know, at first I'm scratching my head thinking, well, we got to ship these big boxes to places.
Yeah.
That happens once.
Right.
I mean, we're talking about trucks, all the big old trucks all the time to get lumber and windows.
Oh, yeah.
Places.
I mean, I think we covered this in the carbon podcast, but the amount of transportation, it's not just to the site. Everything, you know, one stick of lumber, my God, has been shipped around a lot, and it started as a tree. You know, it's been, it's crazy the carbon footprint that it takes. So it's like the embodied carbon in our buildings is right now out of control, and we got to get a handle on it. So perhaps this is one one arrow in our quiver.
It is. This is all embodied carbon that we're talking about. I mean, we're not talking about performance now. We're talking about the production of the construction industry.
Okay.
That's all embodied carbon here. That's what we're trying to hit fast. So that's why it becomes even more important.
So, Phil, I'm a green architect.
I hear that.
And
I know I've seen you at the lounge.
All right, so like you are doing you've got Bright Built Homes as well as Kaplan Thompson Architects or whatever, but like so
whatever,
yeah, whatever that that whatever thing you do on the side there, my frenemy, my best frenemy, Phil and I are we compete on everything and
Brightburn and Kaplan
Thompson. Everything we do, and it's great.
It is.
I win some, you win some, then we go to the bar.
That's right.
Anyway, so like if I'm an architect out there, I'm a green architect, I'm like, you know, I want to get into some of this panelization. I want to be a part of this movement, but I don't have a panelization company or any offsite construction like that. I'm not going to start my own company, but is there a way to start teaming up or designing the buildings to start utilizing panelization or modular construction?
Yeah, you know, there's easier ways to do it.
Yeah.
Some of which you've already done already, right? Built panelized.
Yep.
And, but, you know, that's working with smart builders because some builders are realizing this is already more cost effective.
Right. I mean, there's like you said, there's like a dearth of trades sometimes out there right now in this economic climate. And, you know, that's another thing. If you can order these panels from these guys who can crank it out and deliver it, that helps with carpentry. But anyway.
Right. It's happening as a matter of course. And I think it's going to continue to happen that way. I think there's a number of builders that already prefer to work with modular.
Right.
So they don't want to hire tradesmen.
So do I just roll up my drawings and go walk into a prefab shop and just go like, hey, I'd like you guys to build this for me. Thanks.
Well, here's a big difference between panelized and modular.
Okay.
Panelized, you can.
Yeah?
It's a lot more suited to just that.
Okay.
Modular is much more difficult.
Okay.
Because you're shipping an entire box.
All right.
Versus just a series of things that you've come up with, and they can modify your things.
So how should...
the whole is harder to...
How should an architect work with a modular company, especially if their client comes to them and says... I want to do modular quick or something like that.
Right. I think the first thing to do is really sit down with a manufacturer.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay.
Fine. Call a meeting. Call them up.
Mm-hmm.
They want more business.
Oh, great.
They'd love to have more business. And they're used to working on lower margins.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of these manufacturers are used to putting out a product that is less expensive than we typically design and build for our clients as custom architects, Chris. So when they realize that, they see that there's actually... more potential for them to make money. More hassle at first, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if they can educate you, Chris, as an architect, and you are enamored with the work that they do, then you'll use them again and again because it makes you look good because you've delivered a product to your clients faster and cheaper.
Gotcha.
So why not? You know, it's just a matter of taking that next step. And once you've got that, then you've got you know, we typically don't hire the modular manufacturer. In most cases, we don't hire the person who builds the windows.
Mm-hmm.
We hire the builder and we specify windows.
Gotcha. Right.
So,
sure.
So, you know, we also have to get the builders interested as well.
Gotcha. Are there any other ways that, you know, this modular construction and panelization, lends itself to high performance? I mean, is it in the assemblies? Is it in the air sealing? Quality control, like everyone thinks. I mean, like
that's a big part of it. So again, like depending on where you are in the world, in Maine, it's hard to get airtight buildings, and sometimes quality buildings when you're building in the wintertime. So if you can build it, you know, in the factories, sure, your tape sticks and your
sure,
you know, that's a simple one. But you know, in some ways, it's harder. One of the things that's harder is testing airtightness. In factories.
All right. Well, let's talk about that. So, like the limitations of this. So, what are the hard things to tackle for offsite construction? What are the
specifically in terms of high performance? That is one of the hardest things.
Airtightness.
We rely on that's one of the things, Chris. When people say how do you start a high performance home? You know, airtight, more insulation, better windows and doors.
Sure.
Boom, boom, boom. You know, that's one of the first three always. And if you can't ensure airtightness, how do we ensure airtightness?
Yeah, how do you do that in a factory?
You know, right, you can't run a blower door.
Right, because you're only like looking at half a house, I guess.
You're either there's a series of panels or you're looking at half a house.
Right.
So, and we've tried with factories, like what if we just covered up half the house? It doesn't, it's just not that easy. You just can't put a single sheet across of, 15 mil poly and tape it off.
So you're still in a very similar situation where you have to deliver the house or deliver the modules or deliver the panels, assemble them in place, and then do the blower door
test. And
then do
it. And you better hope. So that's why getting it right in the factory
is critical.
It's really critical.
All right. So that's
you don't have much of a chance to go back afterwards.
That's kind of a big nugget, a big thing to make sure the factory's getting right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I keep thinking that aero barrier. Do you remember? Did we talk about aero barrier in a past podcast?
I think, I don't know if we did, but yeah. Well, let's talk about it for a second. Oh, hey, pet product. You want to do a pet product?
Pet product. Yeah. I haven't used it yet, but I'm willing to entertain it as a pet.
I have heard about this product. Mm-hmm. So for those of you who aren't familiar, Air Barrier, there's a company that created Aero Seal, and that was for ductwork.
Okay.
And it's essentially fix-a-flat for your duct.
I knew you'd have some way to make it simple.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, we weren't planning to talk about this episode, but anyway, it is... Oh my God. And so then air barrier is designed to work under much lower pressure and it's your whole house. So when you're ready to shell test your house, so like not when your finishes are on, but when you're looking at sheathing and stuff, this company trained.
Oh, I think you can do it when your finishes are on.
Oh, I don't think so.
Really? I think once the sheetrock is on, you can do it.
All right. We're going to have to come back to this one. We weren't planning to talk about this, but
basically you turn it on and you dial it in and they say, how tight of a house do you want? And it sprays these fine.
It's an acetate polymer, I believe.
Is that what that is? That sounds terrifying.
It's what chewing gum is made from.
No. So it's terrifying for your hair. Think of it this way.
It's kind of terrifying. You're basically chewing on an acetate polymer. You're chewing on plastic, your chewing gum. Is that good for you, Phil?
I've never tried it. I don't know.
What? All right. You're just teasing me now. So, but anyway, this is it's like an aerosolized product that you can't be in the building, of course, when this goes. And then as it jets across openings, imagine a gummy little molecule that skids across this situation, this hole, and it sticks. And then the polymer that goes across it speeds up and skids across it and sticks until... You can fill up like they say.
A half inch gap, right?
They say a half inch gap with it. And
suddenly you keep running it until all those holes are closed up and you have an airtight structure. As tight as you want, even though you messed up in the factory. Which makes me think, boy, maybe we shouldn't care so much about how tight things are ahead of time. Let's just do this thing.
It might be the wave of the future.
Yeah, I'm very interested.
I'm very interested, but I'm also still very skeptical about this aerosolized, polymerized product that's just going to get airborne and spread, and how safe is it?
I think they should make it out of something edible.
Well,
like marshmallow.
That's their line, it's like it's chewing gum. Chewing gum's safe. You put it in your mouth all the time. You swallow it sometimes and poop it out 7 years later. So, like, that's good for you, right? Or that's okay. That's inert. And I'm sure, there's been a lot of vetting of it, but it's still not transparent because it's probably... proprietary. I know it's not red list compliant yet.
Right.
I know that for a fact, but anyway, all right. So perhaps that is the saving grace
it
later.
Could be the saving grace because that is one of the hardest things to contend with.
Right. Maybe that'll work.
Yeah. But our good factories right now are having no problems hitting 1.5 ACH 50 and less.
Oh, really?
That's what we basically try to hit 1.5.
And that's tested in the field or in the factory?
That's tested in the field.
Cool.
We always test in the field afterward.
Yep. So 1.5 ACH 50.
Thank you.
All right. Cool.
The other things about high performance and offsite, I'd say that there are design limitations when building offsite to some extent.
Yeah.
But panelized a lot less than modular.
Right.
So
like with modular, are you confined with what you can ship across the road?
You are, and also you're fairly confined to boxes. You can ship a lot of things. And we do dormers, ship separately and things like that. But efficiencies start to go down once you get too funky.
Okay. You want to say efficiencies start? What's that?
That was fine. I can get rid of that.
Okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
There was a thing about right.
Efficiencies go down once you get a little too funky.
Gotcha. And do you have to, I'm just going to quiz you right now. So like over the road, like what's your limitation like with a little escort? Like is it 14 feet? Is that right?
You can do 14 feet without the escort. 16 feet you can go with escort. And we're about to do our first 18-foot box.
Whoa. With
One Factory, which sounds crazy, but
That's pretty fat across the road. So you got to do that at like 2 a.m. with a permit and police escort?
Maybe. I'm not quite sure. Not okay. My problem. They said yes, and we're very happy.
All right. Good luck with that, Phil. That's going to be exciting.
Yeah, that changes things. If you have a full 18-foot house, because suddenly you're, 14-foot wide house is a small house.
Right.
But an 18-foot wide house is something we might design as a stick-built house.
Yeah. Well, and that also is like halfway across the other lane, too. So like, you're going to take up both lanes with that or something. I don't know.
They're figuring it out, and we'll see where that one goes. And up to, we usually say 62 feet long.
Dang.
Some companies, Vermont, we didn't mention Vermont. They're out of Vermont, if you haven't guessed. They're doing some amazing
buildings. Vermod, M-O-D.
Vermod, yes.
Okay.
And they ship up to 70. They've modified their
How the hell do you trailers. Do 70 feet?
They've modified their own trailers.
Oh my God, 70 feet. That's like. That's
badass.
That's like bridge parts that, has a full on escort and. I don't know.
It's like a deluxe Winnebago, an 18x70.
No kidding.
You never 70? Need to leave.
Holy crap. Yeah. That's big. Okay. All right. Well, my horizons are opened up on that. I thought it was like 14x40, and that's what you want to stick with. But
yeah. Well, we try to do most of our modules within 14x30. If we can do two 14x30s, then we can stack two modules.
Gotcha.
On one transport vehicle.
Yep.
It's super efficient. And we design our houses around that size, and then we save money.
Right. So when these things get installed, like one of the things that John Straub really drove home in the presentation that we saw, it was always like the weather is, they have to be designed to be installed in terrible, terrible conditions.
Right.
And are they set up to do that? Like they're being shipped, they shrink wrapped? Is that what happens?
They're shrink wrapped. But, multifamily is also very different than residential. Residential, you've got four, five, six boxes.
Yeah.
You set those in a day. And if it's raining that day, you call off the set. You just don't mess with it. But if you've got multifamily, if you've got like 50 boxes and you're trying to build something big, then yes, you have to be much more careful.
Gotcha.
We haven't done that yet.
Hmm.
A lot of people have, and it's still, if it's the future, it's the future. It's going everywhere, every type of building.
Well, I feel like that's the theme of this podcast. It's the future going everywhere.
Yeah. There's certain things that, of note, Chris, that, different systems don't work well for, like modular.
Yeah.
Can't really put it on a slab.
Oh, can I guess why?
Guess why?
Because you have to ship it with a floor.
That's right.
So then if you put that floor on a slab, then you kind of have two floors, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, you could cut out the floor, but isn't that where usually the plumbing is?
Yeah.
And you need access to that plumbing. So how are you going to get access?
We're trying to get rid of concrete now anyway, as much as we can.
Yep. Right.
So maybe you make that work for you.
Right. We've got an in-law flat that goes on 10 piers.
Oh, there you go.
That's right.
Cool.
Yeah. Panelize is a great system. It's more flexible.
Yeah.
There's a lot more to do on site. Modular, if you can get modular down, you have windows in. I mean, a lot of panels, windows are not in. Some places are shipping panels with windows.
Right. Windows and siding, which kind of blows my mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's possible. Are you doing that? Like you're doing full on modules.
Yeah. We've got a handful of products, our Sidekick and our Bright Built Barn. That are single modules, so they can be completed really in the factory. You know, this is bathrooms and kitchens all in.
Wow.
Siding, you drop it down, there's no seams.
Yeah.
You have to connect to the utilities and you're in and out in a week, really. Vermod's another company that's doing a lot, a product that you set it and you're virtually done.
Wow.
So that's modular over panelized. Right. But if you can deal with the limitations.
Sure. Yeah, I think I'm more, I think panelizing is a lot more geared towards the architect who's not used to this yet. Mm-hmm. I think it's very easy to pivot towards panelization.
Well, there, I mean, SIPs. Again, like, have you used SIPs before?
Yes, I have. Yeah, yeah. A few times. Doing a project structural right
insulated
now.
Panels.
Right. Thank you. Yep. And yeah, there's sort of a shop drawing process. You know, you draw it or you figure out what you want. You can figure out the panels yourself or send it off to the, or the builder or whoever can send it off to the SIP manufacturer and they'll send it right back to you saying, this is how we're going to cut out the panels. Make sure it works for everything.
But you know what you got to do when you do that?
Yeah.
You got to get everything right.
Yes. That's right.
That's hard for architects. You know, here we are. The learning curve for architects is still there.
Well, I tell you, I just had this project that we just did. We did the shop drawings and even marked. We found one panel that was in backwards, which sounds weird and ridiculous. But when you have like these different modules and different elevations that you're looking at it in, they just, you know, showed it backwards. We circled it and said backwards, you know, flip it around. Nope, it arrived just as it was, and they missed our note or something like that.
So, but it's even still hard to catch for smart people.
Exactly. I mean, that was...
And there's a lot of smart people in those factories, but, you know...
Exactly. It happens.
It's just a lot of people. Yeah. Some, you know, those errors happen.
Right. And that's my story.
Yeah. That's a good story.
What? I feel good about this podcast right now. I think we've covered most everything.
I think we have. Do you feel like it's something you'd want to try?
Yeah,
next year?
Yeah, I'm already at a place where I'm happy to start looking at panelization. But I think through this conversation that you and I have talked about, I think, you know, I could look at more modular things with a little bit more confidence. I mean, like, it's just because it's modular doesn't mean I don't get an R40 wall. I could get that R40 wall. I just have to have that conversation with the manufacturer ahead of time.
And it's possible that you can get that high-performance home for your client and save a little money if you play by their rules.
Yep.
And maybe so that right there makes us as architects, it puts us in a better position.
Yeah. Did you have a 6-digit idea for this podcast? I can't remember. We talked about ideas.
Yeah. The thing that got me thinking was, remember we talked about Carbon Cure?
Oh, yeah.
That carbon entrained concrete.
Yeah, the micronized carbon.
Yeah, why can't we do that for more materials? What if there was a carbon entrained siding? And I started thinking about that and then our siding podcast, Chris.
Oh, yeah.
What if we could get a Boral type composite siding that was really carbon?
And they just entrain carbon dioxide in the fiber cement or in the whatever that composite is.
We get rid of carbon by nailing on our walls.
Wow. I love that idea. Do you have a...
How do you do it? I don't know. They're ideas. They're just concepts.
All right, great.
We're the visionaries, Chris.
That's right.
We're not the doers.
It's not our burden. That is for everyone else out there.
So I'm excited that you have a song of the episode.
Yeah, I think this stemmed from the fact that we're seat of the pants throwing this stuff together at the last minute, and then you just said, Chris, you pick a song. I'm like, all right, I'm going to pick a song. So here we go.
It's an awesome one.
So I can't remember where I first heard of Sudan Archives. That's who we're talking about. That's not her birth name. That's like her stage name. And if I were like you, Phil, I'd already know her full backstory and her real name. I know she's from Cincinnati originally.
All right, that counts.
But ended up in L.A. She's a violinist, but definitely is not to be pinned down as your orchestral regular violinist. I think she's a self-taught violinist with hip-hop vibes. So if you just want something different, which is what I crave like most of the time these days, is I want someone who's just going to kind of not be boxed in any particular shape or form or anything like that. So this is Sudan Archives with a song called Confessions. She's got a brand new album out coming out 2019. Any day now. No one knows exactly when.
That's awesome. I think it's super fun. I liked what I heard.
It's very cool.
And you know what I also love that you did? And we'll put a link to it.
Yeah.
Somewhere. So Chris put together a Spotify playlist.
That's right. So when you're on Spotify and you type in, you search for Green Architects Lounge to find our podcast, you will find the podcast, but you'll also be like, what's this thing posted by this guy named Chris Briley? Oh, that is all the song selections we've chosen over the many years. And remember, guys, it's been many years. So, you know, it's a journey through the past decade or so of our songs that we featured at the end of our
podcast. You don't kick out 50 podcasts in a couple of years.
But then I noticed it's not 50 songs, Phil. That's because we have a lot of 2 and 3 parters.
Yeah.
So whatever.
So, you know, it'd be fun. Next step is to put a little compendium of our cocktail recipes.
Oh, we should do that. A little Green Architects Lounge cookbook.
That's right.
Right. Of your favorite cocktails.
Well, Chris.
Phil.
Thanks for indulging me. I've been really looking forward to doing the offsite construction high performance.
I think it was an excellent selection for our 50th. Happy 50th podcast, Phil.
Thank you. Happy to you. Cheers, right. Chris.
Cheers, buddy. I fell down and started. Too unique to nail. I washed away my fears and trust in my own ears. My own regret revealed. There is a place that I call home, but it's not where I am welcome. And if I saw all the angels, why is my presence so painful? It's not over yet. Hey, Phil.
One more thing.
Update
from the field.
Update from the field. Check this out. I got an email postcard. An email postcard, if you will, from guess who?
Sheila?
Sheila.
Sheila? Really?
Sheila. Dear Phil.
Oh, my God.
And Chris. I'm gonna paraphrase because she sends her best. She and her partner, Alex. Our
Alex. Oh, okay. Yeah. So we knew she was.
Yep. She and Alex. Oh,
she's always very little secretive.
She is wishing us a very happy 50th podcast episode. She and Scooter, their dog. Remember Scooter?
Yeah.
He's getting on in age, but he's still happy.
Yeah, he was a basset.
He's some mutt. He's a mutt. He's got
German.
big ass ears.
Except a little.
And he's kind
poodle.
And,
I think he was a poodle.
He had some poodle in him.
Yeah,
he's got some poodle in him,
or white, one of the two.
But she wishes us all the best drinks, all the best podcasts, and
so nice to hear from Sheila. For those of you who don't, what else?
Yeah, and well, no, she's in Pittsburgh. working for, I think it's Maytag.
Maytag, really? Yeah. So she's got time on her hands.
I guess.
That's really good to know. That's
she's working for Maytag, doing administrative things, but yeah. She and Alex are having a great time. She's got a picture sent that we'll put up on our lame Facebook page where it's her, Alex, and Scooter. And
she carried us through many, many podcasts, didn't she? We relied on her.
Oh, yeah.
Right? She, you know, she was.
There was no way we were going to get together.
I think she actually introduced us. Didn't she connect us at some point?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, kinda. I think so. She preceded Tanner.
So she says.
Our very real assistant.
That's right. So she says hi. She says hi to all of our fans and wishes us well. And it was worth coming back on the air just to say that for those of you who stuck around. So a little Easter egg for you guys at the end. So happy 50th, Phil.
Happy 50th, Chris.
All right. Cheers.
Cheers.